civilizing process is incomplete, because it appeals to a process that is endogenous to the phenomenon it is trying to explain. A decline in violent behavior, it says, coincided with a decline in impulsiveness, honor, sexual license, incivility, and boorishness at the dinner table. But this just entangles us in a web of psychological processes. It hardly counts as an explanation to say that people behaved less violently because they learned to inhibit their violent impulses. Nor can we feel confident that people's impulsiveness changed first and that a reduction in violence was the result, rather than the other way around. But Elias did propose an exogenous trigger to get the whole thing started. Indeed, two triggers. The first was the consolidation of a genuine Leviathan after centuries of anarchy in Europe's feudal patchwork of baronies and fiefs. Centralized monarchies gained in strength, brought the warring knights under their control, and extended their tentacles into the outer reaches of their kingdoms. According to the military historian Quincy Wright, Europe had 5,000 independent political units, mainly baronies and principalities, in the 15th century, 500 at the time of the Thirty Years' War in the early 17th, 200 at the time of Napoleon in the early 19th, and fewer than 30 in 1953. The consolidation of political units was, in part, a natural process of agglomeration, in which a moderately powerful warlord swallowed his neighbors and became a still more powerful warlord. But the process was accelerated by what historians call the military revolution, the appearance of gunpowder weapons, standing armies, and other expansive technologies of war that could only be supported by a large bureaucracy and revenue base. A guy on a horse with a sword and a ragtag band of peasants was no match for the massed infantry and artillery that a genuine state could put on the battlefield. As the sociologist Charles Tilly put it, states make war, and vice versa. Turf battles among knights were a nuisance to the increasingly powerful kings because, regardless of which side prevailed, peasants were killed and productive capacity was destroyed that, from the king's point of view, would be better off stoking their revenues and armies. And once they got into the peace business, the king's peace, as it was called, they had an incentive to do it right. But for a knight to lay down his arms and let the state deter his enemies was a risky move, because his enemies could see it as a sign of weakness. The state had to keep up its end of the bargain, lest everyone lose faith in its peacekeeping powers and resume their raids and vendettas. Feuding among knights and peasants was not just a nuisance, but a lost opportunity. During Norman rule in England, some genius recognized the lucrative possibilities in nationalizing justice. For centuries, the legal system had treated homicide as a tort. In lieu of vengeance, the victim's family would demand a payment from the killer's family, known as blood money, or Wehrgeld, man payment. The Wehr is the same prefix as in werewolf, man-wolf. King Henry I redefined homicide as an offense against the state, and its metonym, the crown. Murder cases were no longer John Doe versus Richard Roe, but the crown versus John Doe, or later in the United States, the people versus John Doe, or the state of Michigan versus John Doe. The brilliance of the plan was that the Wehrgeld, often the offender's entire assets, together with additional money rounded up from his family, went to the king instead of to the family of the victim. Justice was administered by roving courts that would periodically visit a locale and hear the accumulated cases. To ensure that all homicides were presented to the court, each death was investigated by a local agent of the crown, the coroner. Once Leviathan was in charge, the rules of the game changed. A man's ticket to fortune was no longer being the baddest knight in the area, but making a pilgrimage to the king's court and currying favor with him and his entourage. The court, basically a government bureaucracy, had no use for hotheads and loose cannons, but sought responsible custodians to run its provinces. The nobles had to change their marketing. They had to cultivate their manners so as not to offend the king's minions, and their empathy to understand what they wanted. The manners appropriated for the court came to be called courtly manners or courtesy. The etiquette guides, with their advice on where to place one's nasal mucus, originated as manuals for how to behave in the king's court. Elias traces the centuries-long sequence in which courtesy percolated down from aristocrats dealing with the court to the elite bourgeoisie dealing with the aristocrats, and from them to the rest of the middle class. He summed up his theory, which linked the centralization of state power to a psychological change in the populace, with a slogan, "Warriors to Courtiers." The second exogenous change during the later Middle Ages was an economic revolution. The economic base of the feudal system was land and the peasants who worked it. As real estate agents like to say, land is the one thing they can't make more of. In an economy based on land, if someone wants to improve his standard of living, or for that matter, maintain it during a Malthusian population expansion, his primary option is to conquer the neighboring lot. In the language of game theory, competition for land is zero sum. One player's gain is another player's loss. The zero-sum nature of the medieval economy was reinforced by a Christian ideology that was hostile to any commercial practice or technological innovation that might eke more wealth out of a given stock of physical resources. As Tuckman explains, the Christian attitude toward commerce held that money was evil, that according to St. Augustine, business is in itself an evil, that profit beyond a minimum necessary to support the dealer was avarice, that to make money out of money by charging interest on a loan was the sin of usury, that buying goods wholesale and selling them unchanged at a higher retail price was immoral and condemned by canon law, that, in short, St. Jerome's dictum was final. A man who is a merchant can seldom, if ever, please God. As my grandfather would have put it, Goyisher Kopf, Gentile head. Jews were brought in as moneylenders and middlemen, but were just as often persecuted and expelled. The era's economic backwardness was enforced by laws which decreed that prices should be fixed at a just level, reflecting the cost of the raw material and the value of the labor added to it. To ensure that no one gained an advantage over anyone else, Tuckman explains, commercial law prohibited innovation in tools or techniques, underselling below a fixed price, working late by artificial light, employing extra apprentices or wife and underage children, and advertising of wares or praising them to the detriment of others. This is a recipe for a zero-sum game, and leaves predation as the only way people could add to their wealth. A positive-sum game is a scenario in which agents have choices that can improve the lots of both of them at the same time. A classic positive-sum game in everyday life is in the exchange of favors, where each person can confer a large benefit to another at a small cost to himself or herself. Examples include primates who remove ticks from each other's backs, hunters who share meat whenever one of them has felled an animal that is too big for him to consume on the spot, and parents who take turns keeping each other's children out of trouble. As we shall see in Chapter 8, a key insight of evolutionary psychology is that human cooperation and the social emotions that support it, such as sympathy, trust, gratitude, guilt, and anger, were selected because they allow people to flourish in positive-sum games. A classic positive-sum game in economic life is the trading of surpluses. If a farmer has more grain than he can eat, and a herder has more milk than he can drink, both of them come out ahead if they trade some wheat for some milk. As they say, everybody wins. Of course, an exchange at a single moment in time only pays when there is a division of labor. There would be no point in one farmer giving a bushel of wheat to another farmer and receiving a bushel of wheat in return. A fundamental insight of modern economics is that the key to the creation of wealth is a division of labor, in which specialists learn to produce a commodity with increasing cost effectiveness and have the means to exchange their specialized products efficiently. One infrastructure that allows efficient exchange is transportation, which makes it possible for producers to trade their surpluses even when they are separated by distance. Another is money, interest, and middlemen, which allow producers to exchange many kinds of surpluses with many other producers at many points in time. Positive-sum games also change the incentives for violence. If you're trading favors or surpluses with someone, your trading partner suddenly becomes more valuable to you alive than dead. You have an incentive, moreover, to anticipate what he wants, the better to supply it to him in exchange for what you want. Though many intellectuals, following in the footsteps of Saints Augustine and Jerome, hold business people in contempt for their selfishness and greed, in fact, a free market puts a premium on empathy. A good business person has to keep the customer satisfied, or a competitor will woo them away. And the more customers he attracts, the richer he will be. This idea, which came to be called doux commerce, gentle commerce, which was expressed by the economist Samuel Ricard in 1704. Commerce attaches people to one another through mutual utility. Through commerce, man learns to deliberate, to be honest, to acquire manners, to be prudent and reserved in both talk and action. Sensing the necessity to be wise and honest in order to succeed, he flees vice, or at least his demeanor exhibits decency and seriousness, so as not to arouse any adverse judgment on the part of present and future acquaintances. And this brings us to the second exogenous change. Elias noted that in the late Middle Ages, people began to unmire themselves from technological and economic stagnation. Money increasingly replaced barter, aided by the larger national territories in which a currency could be recognized. The building of roads, neglected since Roman times, resumed, allowing the transport of goods to the hinterlands of the country, and not just along its coasts and navigable rivers. Horse transport became more efficient with the use of horseshoes that protected hooves from paving stones and yokes that didn't choke the poor horse when it pulled a heavy load. Wheeled carts, compasses, clocks, spinning wheels, treadle looms, windmills and water mills were also perfected in the later Middle Ages. And the specialized expertise needed to implement these technologies was cultivated in an expanding stratum of craftsmen. The advances encouraged the division of labor, increased surpluses, and lubricated the machinery of exchange. Life presented people with more positive-sum games and reduced the attractiveness of zero-sum plunder. To take advantage of the opportunities, people had to plan for the future, control their impulses, take other people's perspectives, and exercise the other social and cognitive skills needed to prosper in social networks. The two triggers of the civilizing process, the Leviathan and gentle commerce, are related. The positive-sum cooperation of commerce flourishes best inside a big tent presided over by a Leviathan. Not only is a state well-suited to provide the public goods that serve as infrastructure for economic cooperation, such as money and roads, but it can put a thumb on the scale on which players weigh the relative payoffs of raiding and trading. Suppose a knight can either plunder 10 bushels of grain from his neighbor, or, by expending the same amount of time and energy, raise the money to buy 5 bushels from him. The theft option looks pretty good. But if the knight anticipates that the state will fine him 6 bushels for the theft, he'd be left with only 4. So he's better off with honest toil. Not only do the Leviathan's incentives make commerce more attractive, but commerce makes the job of the Leviathan easier. If the honest alternative of buying the grain hadn't been available, the state would have had to threaten to squeeze 10 bushels out of the knight to deter him from plundering, which is harder to enforce than squeezing 5 bushels out of him. Of course, in reality, the state's sanctions may be the threat of physical punishment rather than a fine, but the principle is the same. It's easier to deter people from a crime if the lawful alternative is more appealing. The two civilizing forces, then, reinforce each other, and Elias considered them to be part of a single process. The centralization of state control and its monopolization of violence, the growth of craft guilds and bureaucracies, the replacement of barter with money, the development of technology, the enhancement of trade, the growing webs of dependency among far-flung individuals all fit into an organic whole. And to prosper within that whole, one had to cultivate faculties of empathy and self-control until they became, as he put it, second nature. Indeed, the organic analogy is not far-fetched. The biologists John Maynard Smith and Eeyore Sainte-Marie have argued that an evolutionary dynamic similar to the civilizing process drove the major transitions in the history of life. These transitions were the successive emergence of genes, chromosomes, bacteria, cells with nuclei, organisms, sexually reproducing organisms, and animal societies. In each transition, entities with the capacity to be either selfish or cooperative tended toward cooperation when they could be subsumed into a larger whole. They specialized, exchanged benefits, and developed safeguards to prevent one of them from exploiting the rest to the detriment of the whole. The journalist Robert Wright sketches a similar arc in his book Non-Zero, an allusion to positive-sum games, and extends it to the history of human societies. In the final chapter of this book, I will take a closer look at overarching theories of the decline of violence. The theory of the civilizing process passed a stringent test for a scientific hypothesis. It made a surprising prediction that turned out to be true. Back in 1939, Elias had no access to the statistics of homicide. He worked from narrative histories and old books of etiquette. When Gurr, Eisner, Coburn, and others surprised the world of criminology with their graphs showing a decline in killings, Elias had the only theory that anticipated it. But with everything else we have learned about violence in recent decades, how well does the theory fare? Elias himself was haunted by the not-so-civilized behavior of his native Germany during World War II, and he labored to explain that de-civilizing process within the framework of his theory. He discussed the fitful history of German unification and the resulting lack of trust in a legitimate central authority. He documented the persistence of a militaristic culture of honor among its elites, the breakdown of a state monopoly on violence with the rise of communist and fascist militias, and a resulting contraction of empathy for groups perceived to be outsiders, particularly the Jews. It would be a stretch to say that he rescued his theory with these analyses, but perhaps he shouldn't have tried. The horrors of the Nazi era did not consist in an upsurge in feuding among warlords or of citizens stabbing each other over the dinner table, but in violence whose scale, nature, and causes are altogether different. In fact, in Germany during the Nazi years, the declining trend for one-on-one homicides continued. In Chapter 8, we will see how the compartmentalization of the moral sense and the distribution of belief and enforcement among different sectors of a population can lead to ideologically driven wars and genocides, even in otherwise civilized societies. Eisner pointed out another complication for the theory of the civilizing process. The decline of violence in Europe and the rise of centralized states did not always proceed in lockstep. Belgium and the Netherlands were at the forefront of the decline, yet they lacked strong centralized governments. When Sweden joined the trend, it wasn't on the heels of an expansion in state power either. Conversely, the Italian states were in the rear guard of the decline in violence, yet their governments wielded an enormous bureaucracy and police force. Nor did cruel punishments, the enforcement method of choice among early modern monarchs, reduce violence in the areas where they were carried out with the most relish. Many criminologists believe that the source of the state's pacifying effect isn't just its brute coercive power, but the trust it commands among the populace. After all, no state can post an informant in every pub and farmhouse to monitor breaches of the law. And those that try are totalitarian dictatorships that rule by fear, not civilized societies where people coexist through self-control and empathy. A leviathan can civilize a society only when the citizens feel that its laws, law enforcement, and other social arrangements are legitimate. so that they don't fall back on their worst impulses as soon as Leviathan's back is turned. This doesn't refute Elias's theory, but it adds a twist. An imposition of the rule of law may end the bloody mayhem of feuding warlords, but reducing rates of violence further to the levels enjoyed by modern European societies involves a more nebulous process in which certain populations accede to the rule of law that has been imposed on them. Libertarians, anarchists, and other skeptics of the Leviathan point out that when communities are left to their own devices, they often develop norms of cooperation that allow them to settle their disputes non-violently, without laws, police, courts, or the other trappings of government. In Moby Dick, Ishmael explains how American whalers, thousands of miles from the reach of the law, dealt with disputes over whales that had been injured or killed by one ship and then claimed by another. Thus, the most vexatious and violent disputes would often arise between the fishermen, were there not some written or unwritten, universal, undisputed law applicable to all cases. Though no other nation but Holland has ever had any written whaling law, yet the American fishermen have been their own legislators and lawyers in this matter. These laws might be engraven on a Queen Anne's farthing, or the barb of a harpoon, and worn round the neck, so small are they. 1. A fast fish belongs to the party fast to it. 2. A loose fish is fair game for anybody who can soonest catch it. Informal norms of this kind have emerged among fishers, farmers, and herders in many parts of the world. In Order Without Law, How Neighbors Settle Disputes, the legal scholar Robert Ellickson studied a modern American version of the ancient and frequently violent confrontation between pastoralists and farmers. In Northern California's Shasta County, traditional ranchers are essentially cowboys, grazing their cattle in open country, while modern ranchers raise cattle in irrigated, fenced ranches. Both kinds of ranchers coexist with farmers who grow hay, alfalfa, and other crops. Straying cattle occasionally knock down fences, eat crops, foul streams, and wander onto roads where vehicles can hit them. The county is carved into open ranges, in which an owner is not legally liable for most kinds of accidental damage his cattle may cause, and closed ranges, in which he is strictly liable, whether he was negligent or not. Ellickson discovered that victims of harm by cattle were loath to invoke the legal system to settle the damages. In fact, most of the residents, ranchers, farmers, insurance adjusters, even lawyers and judges, held beliefs about the applicable laws that were flat wrong. But the residents got along by adhering to a few tacit norms. Cattle owners were always responsible for the damage their animals caused, whether a range was open or closed. But if the damage was minor and sporadic, property owners were expected to lump it. People kept rough, long-term mental accounts of who owed what, and the debts were settled in kind rather than in cash. For example, a cattleman whose cow damaged a rancher's fence might at a later time board one of the rancher's stray cattle at no charge. Deadbeats and violators were punished with gossip and with occasional veiled threats or minor vandalism. In Chapter 9, we'll take a closer look at the moral psychology behind such norms, which falls into a category called equality matching. As important as tacit norms are, it would be a mistake to think that they obviate a role for government. The Shasta County ranchers may not have called in Leviathan when a cow knocked over a fence, but they were living in its shadow and knew it would step in if their informal sanctions escalated or if something bigger were at stake, such as a fight, a killing, or a dispute over women. And as we shall see, their current level of peaceful coexistence is itself the legacy of a local version of the civilizing process. In the 1850s, the annual homicide rate of Northern California ranchers was around 45 per 100,000. Comparable to those of medieval Europe. I think the theory of the civilizing process provides a large part of the explanation for the modern decline of violence, not only because it predicted the remarkable plunge in European homicide, but because it makes correct predictions about the times and places in the modern era that do not enjoy the blessed 1 per 100,000 per year rate of modern Europe. Two of these rule-proving exceptions are zones that the civilizing process never fully penetrated: the lower strata of the socioeconomic scale, and the inaccessible or inhospitable territories of the globe. And two are zones in which the civilizing process went into reverse: the developing world and the 1960s. Let's visit them in turn. Violence and class. Other than the drop in numbers, the most striking feature of the decline in European homicide is the change in the socioeconomic profile of killing. Centuries ago, rich people were as violent as poor people, if not more so. Gentlemen would carry swords and would not hesitate to use them to avenge insults. They often traveled with retainers who doubled as bodyguards, so an affront or a retaliation for an affront could escalate into a bloody street fight between gangs of aristocrats, as in the opening scene of Romeo and Juliet. The economist Gregory Clark examined records of deaths of English aristocrats from late medieval times to the Industrial Revolution. In the 14th and 15th centuries, an astonishing 26% of aristocrats died from violence, about the same rate as the average for pre-literate tribes. The rate fell into the single digits by the turn of the 18th century, and of course today, it is essentially zero. A homicide rate measured in percentage points is still remarkably high, and well into the 18th and 19th centuries, violence was a part of the lives of respectable men, such as Alexander Hamilton and Aaron Burr. Boswell quotes Samuel Johnson, who presumably had no trouble defending himself with words, as saying, "I have beat many a fellow, but the rest had the wit to hold their tongues." Members of the upper classes eventually refrained from using force against one another, but with the law watching their backs, they reserved the right to use it against their inferiors. As recently as 1859, the British author of The Habits of a Good Society advised, "There are men whom nothing but a physical punishment will bring to reason, and with these we shall have to deal at some time of our lives. A lady is insulted or annoyed by an unwieldy bargee or an importunate and dishonest cabman. One well-dealt blow settles the whole matter. A man, therefore, whether he aspires to be a gentleman or not, should learn to box. There are but few rules for it, and those are suggested by common sense. Strike out, strike straight, strike suddenly. Keep one arm to guard and punish with the other. Two gentlemen never fight. The art of boxing is brought into use in punishing a stronger and more imprudent man of a class beneath your own." The European decline of violence was spearheaded by a decline in elite violence. Today, statistics from every Western country show that the overwhelming majority of homicides and other violent crimes are committed by people in the lowest socioeconomic classes. One obvious reason for the shift is that in medieval times, one achieved high status through the use of force. The journalist Stephen Saylor recounts an exchange from early 20th century England. A hereditary member of the British House of Lords complained that Prime Minister Lloyd George had created new lords solely because they were self-made millionaires who had only recently acquired large acreages. When asked, "How did your ancestor become a lord?" he replied sternly, "With the battle axe, sir. With the battle axe." As the upper classes were putting down their battle axes, disarming their retinues, and no longer punching out bargees and cabmen, the middle classes followed suit. They were domesticated not by the royal court, of course, but by other civilizing forces. Employment in factories and businesses forced employees to acquire habits of decorum. An increasingly democratic political process allowed them to identify with the institutions of government and society, and it opened up the court system as a way to pursue their grievances. And then came an institution that was introduced in London in 1828 by Sir Robert Peel, and soon named after him: the municipal police, or Bobbies. The main reason that violence correlates with low socioeconomic status today is that the elites in the middle class pursue justice with the legal system, while the lower classes resort to what scholars of violence call self-help. This has nothing to do with women who love too much or chicken soup for the soul. It is another name for vigilantism, frontier justice, taking the law into your own hands, and other forms of violent retaliation by which people secure justice in the absence of intervention by the state. In an influential article called Crime as Social Control, the legal scholar Donald Black argued that most of what we call crime is, from the point of view of the perpetrator, the pursuit of justice. Black began with a statistic that has long been known to criminologists. Only a minority of homicides, perhaps as few as 10%, are committed as a means to a practical end, such as killing a homeowner during a burglary, a policeman during an arrest, or the victim of a robbery or rape, because dead people tell no tales. The most common motives for homicide are moralistic: retaliation after an insult, escalation of a domestic quarrel, punishing an unfaithful or deserting romantic partner, and other acts of jealousy, revenge, and self-defense. Black cites some cases from a database in Houston. One in which a young man killed his brother during a heated discussion about the latter's sexual advances toward his younger sisters. Another in which a man killed his wife after she dared him to do so during an argument about which of several bills they should pay. One where a woman killed her husband during a quarrel in which the man struck her daughter, his stepdaughter. One in which a woman killed her 21-year-old son because he had been fooling around with homosexuals and drugs. And two others, in which people died from wounds inflicted during altercations over the parking of an automobile. Most homicides, Black notes, are really instances of capital punishment, with a private citizen as the judge, jury, and executioner. It's a reminder that the way we conceive of a violent act depends on which of the corners of the violence triangle we stake out as our vantage point: aggressor, victim, or bystander. Consider a man who is arrested and tried for wounding his wife's lover. From the point of view of the law, the aggressor is the husband and the victim is society, which is now pursuing justice. An interpretation, recall, captured in the naming of court cases, such as The People v. John Doe. From the point of view of the lover, the aggressor is the husband, and he is the victim. If the husband gets off on an acquittal or mistrial or plea bargain, there is no justice, as the lover is enjoined from pursuing revenge. And from the point of view of the husband, he is the victim of cuckoldry. The lover is the aggressor, and justice has been done. But now he is the victim of a second act of aggression in which the state is the aggressor and the lover is an accomplice. Black notes, those who commit murder often appear to be resigned to their fate at the hands of the authorities. Many wait patiently for the police to arrive. Some even call to report their own crimes. In cases of this kind, indeed, the individuals involved might arguably be regarded as martyrs. Not unlike workers who violate a prohibition to strike, knowing they will go to jail, or others who defy the law on grounds of principle, they do what they think is right and willingly suffer the consequences. These observations overturn many dogmas about violence. One is that violence is caused by a deficit of morality and justice. On the contrary, violence is often caused by a surfeit of morality and justice, at least as they are conceived in the minds of the perpetrators. Another dogma, cherished among psychologists and public health researchers, is that violence is a kind of disease. But this public health theory of violence flouts the basic definition of a disease, namely a malfunction that causes suffering to the individual. Most violent people insist there is nothing wrong with them. It's the victim and bystanders who think there's a problem. A third dubious belief about violence is that lower-class people engage in it because they are financially needy, for example, stealing food to feed their children, or because they are expressing rage against society. The violence of a lower-class man may indeed express rage, but it is aimed not at society, but at the asshole who scraped his car and dissed him in front of a crowd. In an article inspired by Black called The Decline of Elite Homicide, the criminologist Mark Cooney shows that many lower-status people, the poor, the uneducated, the unmarried, and members of minority groups, are effectively stateless. Some make a living from illegal activities like drug dealing, gambling, selling stolen goods, and prostitution, so they cannot file lawsuits or call the police to enforce their interests in business disputes. In that regard, they share their need for recourse to violence with certain high-status people, namely dealers in contraband such as mafiosi, drug kingpins, and prohibition rum runners. But another reason for their statelessness is that lower-status people and the legal system often live in a condition of mutual hostility. Black and Cooney report that in dealing with low-income African Americans, police seem to vacillate between indifference and hostility, reluctant to become involved in their affairs, but heavy-handed when they do so. Judges and prosecutors, too, tend to be uninterested in the disputes of low-status people, typically disposing of them quickly and, to the parties involved, with an unsatisfactory penal emphasis. Here is a Harlem police sergeant quoted by the journalist Heather McDonald. "Last weekend, a known neighborhood knucklehead hit a kid. In retaliation, the kid's whole family shows up at the perp's apartment. The victim's sisters kick in the apartment door. But the knucklehead's mother beats the shit out of the sisters, leaving them lying on the floor with blood coming from their mouths. The victim's family was looking for a fight. I could charge him with trespass. The perp's mother is eligible for assault 3 for beating up the opposing family. But all of them were street shit. Garbage. They will get justice in their own way. I told them, we can all go to jail, or we can call it a wash. Otherwise, you'd have 6 bodies in prison for BS behavior. The district attorney would have been pissed, and none of them would ever show up in court." Not surprisingly, lower status people tend not to avail themselves of the law, and may be antagonistic to it, preferring the age-old alternative of self-help justice and a code of honor. The police sergeant's compliment about the kind of people he deals with in his precinct was returned by the young African Americans interviewed by the criminologist Deanna Wilkinson. Reggie: "The cops working my neighborhood don't belong working in my neighborhood. How are you going to send white cops to a black neighborhood to protect and serve? You can't do that, because all they're going to see is the black faces that's committing the crimes. They all look the same. The ones that's not committing crimes look like the niggas that is committing crimes, and everybody is getting harassed." Dexter: "They make worser 'cause niggas, the police, was fucking niggas, youth up. They crook themselves, you know what I mean? Them niggas, the police officers, would run up on the drug spot, take my drugs. They'll sell that shit back on the street so they could go rush knock someone else." Quentin: "Speaking of a man who had shot his father, there's a chance he could walk. What am I supposed to do? If I lose my father and they don't catch this guy, I'm going to get his family. That's the way it works out here. That's the way all this shit out here works. If you can't get him, get them. Everybody grow up with the shit. They want respect. They want to be the man." The historical civilizing process, in other words, did not eliminate violence, but it did relegate it to the socioeconomic margins. Violence around the world. The civilizing process spread not only downward along the socioeconomic scale, but outward across the geographic scale, from a Western European epicenter. We saw earlier that England was the first to pacify itself, followed closely by Germany and the Low Countries. This decline in the homicide rate ripples outward through Europe. In the late 1800s, Europe had a peaceable bullseye in the northern industrialized countries, Great Britain, France, Germany, Denmark, and the Low Countries, bordered by slightly stroppier Ireland, Austria-Hungary, and Finland, surrounded in turn by still more violent Spain, Italy, Greece, and the Slavic countries. Today, the peaceable center has swelled to encompass all of Western and Central Europe, but a gradient of lawlessness extending to Eastern Europe and the mountainous Balkans is still visible. There are gradients within each of these countries as well. The hinterlands and mountains remained violent long after the urbanized and densely farmed centers had calmed down. Clan warfare was endemic to the Scottish Highlands until the 18th century, and to Sardinia, Sicily, Montenegro, and other parts of the Balkans until the 20th. It's no coincidence that the two blood-soaked classics with which I began this book, the Hebrew Bible and the Homeric poems, came from peoples that lived in rugged hills and valleys. What about the rest of the world? Though most European countries have kept statistics on homicide for a century or more, the same cannot be said for the other continents. Even today, the police blotter tallies that departments report to Interpol are often unreliable and sometimes incredible. Many governments feel that their degree of success in keeping their citizens from murdering each other is no one else's business. And in parts of the developing world, warlords dress up their brigandage in the language of political liberation movements, making it hard to draw a line between casualties in a civil war and homicides from organized crime. With those limitations in mind, let's take a peek at the distribution of homicide in the world today. The most reliable data come from the World Health Organization, WHO, which uses public health records and other sources to estimate the causes of death in as many countries as possible. The UN Office on Drugs and Crime has supplemented these data with high and low estimates for every country in the world. The good news is that the median national homicide rate among the world's countries in this data set is 6 per 100,000 per year. The overall homicide rate for the entire world, ignoring the division into countries, was estimated by the WHO in 2000 as 8.8 per 100,000 per year. Both estimates compare favorably to the triple-digit values for pre-state societies and the double-digit values for medieval Europe. Western and Central Europe make up the least violent region in the world today. Among the other states with credible low rates of homicide are those carved out of the British Empire, such as Australia, New Zealand, Fiji, Canada, the Maldives, and Bermuda. Another former British colony defies the pattern of English civility. We will examine this strange country in the next section. Several Asian countries have low homicide rates as well, particularly those that have adopted Western models, such as Japan, Singapore, and Hong Kong. Also reporting a low homicide rate is China, 2.2 per 100,000. Even if we take the data from this secretive state at face value, in the absence of time series data, we have no way of knowing whether it is best explained by millennia of centralized government or by the authoritarian nature of its current regime. Established autocracies, including many Islamic states, keep close tabs on their citizens and punish them surely and severely when they step out of line. That's why we call them police states. Not surprisingly, they tend to have low rates of violent crime. But I can't resist an anecdote which suggests that China, like Europe, underwent a civilizing process over the long term. Elias noted that knife taboos, which accompanied the reduction of violence in Europe, have been taken one step further in China. For centuries in China, knives have been reserved for the chef in the kitchen, where he cuts the food into bite-sized pieces. Knives are banned from the dining table altogether. "The Europeans are barbarians," Elias quotes them as saying. "They eat with swords." What about the other parts of the world? The criminologist Gary Laufrey and the sociologist Orlando Patterson have shown that the relationship between crime and democratization is an inverted U. Established demographics are relatively safe places, as are established autocracies, but emerging democracies and semi-democracies, also called anocracies, are often plagued by violent crime and vulnerable to civil war, which sometimes shade into each other. The most crime-prone regions in the world today are Russia, sub-Saharan Africa, and parts of Latin America. Many of them have corrupt police forces and judicial systems, which extort bribes out of criminals and victims alike, and dole out protection to the highest bidder. Some, like Jamaica, 33.7, Mexico, 11.1, and Colombia, 52.7, are racked by drug-funded militias that operate beyond the reach of the law. Over the past four decades, as drug trafficking has increased, their rates of homicide have soared. Others, like Russia, 29.7, and South Africa, 69, may have undergone decivilizing processes in the wake of the collapse of their former governments. The decivilizing process has also racked many of the countries that switched from tribal ways to colonial rule, and then suddenly to independence, such as those in sub-Saharan Africa and Papua New Guinea, 15.2. In her article, From Spears to M16s, the anthropologist Polly Weissner examines the historical trajectory of violence among the Enga, a New Guinean tribal people. She begins with an excerpt from the field notes of an anthropologist who worked in their region in 1939. "We were now in the heart of the Lae Valley, one of the most beautiful in New Guinea, if not in the world. Everywhere were fine, well-laid-out garden plots, mostly of sweet potato and groves of casuarinas. Well-cut and graded roads traversed the countryside, and small parks dotted the landscape, which resembled a huge botanical garden." She compares it to her own diary entry from 2004. "The Lae Valley is a virtual wasteland, as the Enga say, cared for by the birds, snakes, and rats. Houses are burned to ash, sweet potato gardens overgrown with weeds, and trees raised to jagged stumps. In the high forest, warfare rages on, fought by Rambos with shotguns and high-powered rifles taking the lives of many. By the roadside, where markets bustled just a few years before, there is an eerie emptiness." The Yenga were never what you could call a peaceable people. One of their tribes, the Mai Enga, killed each other in warfare at an annual rate of about 300 per 100,000, dwarfing the worst rates we have been discussing in this chapter. All the usual Hobbesian dynamics played out: rape and adultery, theft of pigs and land, insults, and, of course, revenge, revenge, and more revenge. Still, the Yenga were conscious of the waste of war, and some of the tribes took steps, intermittently successful, to contain it. For example, they developed Geneva-like norms that outlawed war crimes such as mutilating bodies or killing negotiators. And though they sometimes were drawn into destructive wars with other villages and tribes, they worked to control the violence within their own communities. Every human society is faced with a conflict of interest between the younger men, who seek dominance and ultimately mating opportunities for themselves, and the older men, who seek to minimize internecine damage within their extended families and clans. The Enga elders forced obstreperous young men into bachelor cults, which encouraged them to control their vengeful impulses with the help of proverbs like, "The blood of a man does not wash off easily," and "You live long if you plan the death of a pig, but not if you plan the death of a person." And consonant with other civilizing elements in their culture, they had norms of propriety and cleanliness, which Weissner described to me in an email. The Enga cover themselves with rain capes when they defecate, so as not to offend anybody, even the sun. For a man to stand by the road, turn his back and pee is unthinkably crude. They wash their hands meticulously before they cook food. They are extremely modest about covering genitals, and so on. Not so great with snot. Most important, the Enga took well to the Pax Australiana beginning in the late 1930s. Over the span of two decades, warfare plummeted, and many of the Enga were relieved to set aside violence to settle their disputes and fight in courts instead of on the battlefield. When Papua New Guinea gained independence in 1975, violence among the Enga shot back up. Government officials doled out land and perks to their clansmen, provoking intimidation and revenge from the clans left in the cold. Young men left the bachelor cults for schools that prepared them for non-existent jobs, then joined rascal criminal gangs that were unrestrained by elders and the norms they had imposed. They were attracted by alcohol, drugs, nightclubs, gambling, and firearms, including M16s and AK-47s, and went on rampages of rape, plunder, and arson, not unlike the knights of medieval Europe. The state was weak. Its police were untrained and outgunned, and its corrupt bureaucracy was incapable of maintaining order. In short, the governance vacuum left by instant decolonization put the Papuans through a decivilizing process that left them with neither traditional norms nor modern third-party enforcement. Similar degenerations have occurred in other former colonies in the developing world, forming eddies in the global flow toward lower rates of homicide. It's easy for a Westerner to think that violence in lawless parts of the world is intractable and permanent. But at various times in history, communities have gotten so fed up with the bloodshed that they have launched what criminologists call a civilizing offensive. Unlike the unplanned reductions in homicide that came about as a byproduct of the consolidation of states and the promotion of commerce, a civilizing offensive is a deliberate effort by sectors of a community, often women, elders, or clergy, to tame the Rambos and rascals and restore civilized life. Weissner reports on a civilizing offensive in the Enga province in the 2000s. Church leaders tried to lure young men from the thrill of gang life with exuberant sports, music, and prayer, and to substitute an ethic of forgiveness for the ethic of revenge. Tribal elders, using the cell phones that had been introduced in 2007, developed rapid response units to apprise one another of disputes and rush to the trouble spot before the fighting got out of control. They reined in the most uncontrollable firebrands in their own clans, sometimes with brutal public executions. Community governments were set up to restrict gambling, drinking, and prostitution. And a newer generation was receptive to these efforts, having seen that the lives of Rambos are short and lead nowhere. Weissner quantified the results. After having increased for decades, the number of killings declined significantly from the first half of the 2000s to the second. As we shall see, it was not the only time and place in which a civilizing offensive has paid off. Violence in these United States. Violence is as American as cherry pie. H. Rapp Brown. The Black Panther spokesman may have mixed up his fruits, but he did express a statistically valid generalization about the United States. Among Western democracies, the United States leaps out of the homicide statistics. Instead of clustering with kindred peoples like Britain, the Netherlands, and Germany, it hangs out with toughs like Albania and Uruguay, close to the median rate for the entire world. Not only has the homicide rate for the United States not wafted down to the levels enjoyed by every European and Commonwealth democracy, but it showed no overall decline during the 20th century. The American homicide rate crept up until 1933, nosedived in the 1930s and 40s, remained low in the 1950s, and then was launched skyward in 1962, bouncing around in the stratosphere in the 1970s and 1980s, before returning to Earth starting in 1992. The upsurge in the 1960s was shared with every other Western democracy, and I'll return to it in the next section. But why did the United States start the century with homicide rates so much higher than England's, and never close the gap? Could it be a counterexample to the generalization that countries with good governments and good economies enjoy a civilizing process that pushes their rate of violence downward? And if so, what is unusual about the United States? In newspaper commentaries, one often reads pseudo-explanations like this. Why is America more violent? It's our cultural predisposition to violence. How can we find our way out of this logical circle? It's not just that America is gun happy. Even if you subtract all the killings with firearms and count only the ones with rope, knives, lead pipes, wrenches, candlesticks, and so on, Americans commit murders at a higher rate than Europeans. Europeans have always thought that America is uncivilized, but that is only partly true. A key to understanding American homicide is to remember that the United States was originally a plural noun, as in these United States. When it comes to violence, the United States is not a country. It's three countries. Some of the United States are not so different from Europe after all. They include the aptly named New England states and a band of northern states stretching toward the Pacific, Minnesota, Iowa, the Dakotas, Montana, and the Pacific Northwest states, together with Utah. The band reflects not a common climate, since Oregon's is nothing like Vermont's, but rather the historical roots of migration, which tended to go from east to west. This ribbon of peaceable states, with homicide rates of less than 3 per 100,000 per year, sits at the top of a gradient of increasing homicide from north to south. At the southern end, we find states like Arizona, 7.4, and Alabama, 8.9, which compare unfavorably to Uruguay, 5.3, Jordan, 6.9, and Grenada, 4.9. We also find Louisiana, 14.2, whose rate is close to that of Papua New Guinea, 15.2. A second contrast is less obvious. Louisiana's homicide rate is higher than those of the other southern states, and the District of Columbia, a barely visible black speck, is off the scale at 30.8, in the range of the most dangerous Central American and Southern African countries. These jurisdictions are outliers mainly because they have a high proportion of African Americans. The current black-white difference in homicide rates within the United States is stark. Between 1976 and 2005, the average homicide rate for white Americans was 4.8, while the average rate for black Americans was 36.9. It's not just that blacks get arrested and convicted more often, which would suggest that the race gap might be an artifact of racial profiling. The same gap appears in anonymous surveys in which victims identify the race of their attackers, and in surveys in which people of both races recount their own history of violent offenses. By the way, though the southern states have a higher percentage of African Americans than the northern states, the north-south difference is not a byproduct of the white-black difference. Southern whites are more violent than northern whites, and southern blacks are more violent than northern blacks. So while northern Americans and white Americans are somewhat more violent than western Europeans, whose median homicide rate is 1.4, the gap between them is far smaller than it is for the country as a whole. And a little digging shows that the United States did undergo a state-driven civilizing process, though different regions underwent it at different times and to different degrees. Digging is necessary because for a long time, the United States was a backwards country when it came to keeping track of homicide. Most homicides are prosecuted by individual states, not by the federal government, and good nationwide statistics weren't compiled until the 1930s. Also, until recently, the United States was a moving target. The lower 48 were not fully assembled until 1912, and many states were periodically infused with a shot of immigrants who changed the demographic profile until they coalesced in the melting pot. For these reasons, historians of American violence have had to make do with shorter time series from smaller jurisdictions. In American Homicide, Randolph Roth has recently assembled an enormous number of small-scale data sets for the three centuries of American history before the national statistics were compiled. Though most of the trends are roller coasters rather than toboggan runs, they do show how different parts of the country became civilized as the anarchy of the frontier gave way, in part, to state control. Compare Roth's data from New England with Eisner's compilation of homicide rates from England. The sky-high point for colonial New England represents Roth's Elias-friendly observation that the era of frontier violence, during which the homicide rate stood at over 100 per 100,000 adults per year, ended in 1637, when English colonists and their